the structure of Matthew, we'll talk about tonight, the purpose of Matthew, the quarry of Matthew, and the transmission of Matthew. So those five parts, which is a significant number if you're talking about Matthew, as we're going to find out here in a few minutes. But before we get in further, I'm just going to take a moment to pray. Father, I come before you. I pray for your name to be glorified, and for your blessing on this discussion of your word. Help us to understand Matthew better as a result of this time together. In Jesus' name, I pray. Amen. So during our time together last week, we spoke about the writing, the preserving, and the reading of the fourfold gospel. And while we don't have the time to review all that we covered last week, there are three points of particular importance for what we're covering tonight that we do need to review. So those three points are this, the difference between John and the Synoptic Gospels. So when we talk about the four Gospels, we have John on the one hand, and we have Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the Synoptic Gospels, on the other. And does anyone remember what the term synoptic means? Why do we call Matthew, Mark, and Luke the Synoptic Gospels? Anyone over here? Nate? They same viewpoint, they see together, they're structured around a similar outline. We're going to see that in more detail tonight. And we talked about the reality that there is a literary relationship between the three Gospels. What does that mean? When we say there's a literary relationship between the three Gospels, what does that mean? Does anyone remember that? Over here? Anyone remember? Sarah, what? Yeah, that would be more in terms of the synoptic part of it. But the literary relationship means that one or more of the synoptic gospels wrote with one or more of the other synoptic gospels in front of them. So without specifying exactly what that relationship was, it means that there's a relationship at the level of the written text. That it's not just that they all pick the same outline, but they actually used one another in their writing, or at least one of them used one of the others. And then the third point is Markan priority, and that is that there's evidence that suggests that Mark wrote first and Matthew used Mark. So we say there is a literary relationship. There's some relationship at the level of what's written down between the Synoptic Gospels. And then at least one of those connections is that Mark writes first and Matthew makes use of Mark in writing his own gospel. And so those three points will all become significant in what follows. Tonight we're going to focus on the overall structure of Matthew, dealing with three of the interlocking structures that Matthew uses to help communicate to his readers, to communicate to us the full significance of who Jesus is. So we're going to have three main things we're going to cover tonight. Matthew's narrative, following the outline of Mark. Matthew's discourses, summarizing the teaching of Jesus. And Matthew's symphony, the story of Israel in the key of Jesus. So we're going to talk about Matthew's narrative, Matthew's discourses, and Matthew's symphony, those three things. So we'll start out by talking about Matthew's narrative. And in order to understand Matthew's narrative, in order to understand the narrative flow of how he follows Mark's outline, we need to spend a few minutes talking about what Mark's outline is. In order to understand the structure of Matthew, we have to review the structure of Mark. So after a brief 15-verse introduction that relates the ministry of John the Baptist and the baptism of Jesus, Mark's gospel moves immediately to the call of the disciples in Galilee. And the first half of the Gospel of Mark, chapters 1 through 8, is a whirlwind of activity as Jesus, by his mighty miracles, demonstrates to all that he really is the Messiah. He really is the Son of God. And all the action in this first half of Mark takes place either in Galilee. And so if you have a map of Israel in your mind, you have Galilee up in the north, then you have Samaria, and then you have Judea. And so in Mark's gospel, in the first half of the gospel, all the action takes place in Galilee, which is the northernmost part of Israel. or regions further to the north, Gentile regions further to the north, Gentile regions that are to the east of Galilee. And the turning point of the Gospel of Mark takes place in chapter 8. And there's so many cool things about the way Mark puts his gospel together. But if I get off on a tangent about that, we won't get to talking about Matthew. So I'm having to restrain at this point. But in Mark chapter 8, Jesus and the disciples have journeyed to Caesarea Philippi, one of the Gentile areas to the north of Galilee. And at this point, Peter, speaking for the other apostles, for the first time, clearly confesses Jesus as the Christ, the Messiah. And Jesus says, "Who do men say that I am?" And then he says, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter says, "You are the Christ." And so this is the turning point. Up to this point, Jesus has been demonstrating that he is the Messiah. Peter gets that he is the Messiah. And then the whole perspective of Mark's gospel radically changes. And Jesus is doing all these miracles, all these miraculous things in the first half. And there are very, very few miracles in the second half of Mark, because now in the second half, Jesus is making clear that the Messiah has to suffer. So there's this clear two-part structure to the Gospel of Mark. And during the second half of his Gospel, Mark relates Jesus' final journey south to Jerusalem and the plot of the leaders against him and his crucifixion and resurrection during the time of Passover. In other words, and this is the crucial point, Mark's gospel relates ministry in Galilee and the surrounding regions with Peter's confession of faith in the far north as the turning point, and then it relates a single journey down, down, down south to Jerusalem, where Jesus is crucified and risen again. And while they expand it in various ways, both Matthew and Luke follow this same basic outline. Now, in John's gospel, on the other hand, it becomes clear that Jesus is in Jerusalem for at least three Passovers. And in John's gospel, one of the reasons for the striking differences between John's gospel and the synoptics is, apart from the passion narrative, everything in the synoptics almost takes place in Galilee. But in John's gospel, most of the ministry of Jesus takes place in Judea, and it's relating a lot of Jesus' ministry in and around Jerusalem. To be very clear, the synoptic gospels never say that Jesus only went to Jerusalem once. Yet though they don't contradict the outline that John provides, they do condense it down considerably. And when we remember the testimony of the early church that Mark is a summary of Peter's preaching, it's a preaching outline, this makes a good deal of sense because it's a simple outline that could be proclaimed in a single sermon. And Peter evidently had a habit of organizing his testimony about Jesus into a simple geographical outline that included all the main points needed to understand who Jesus was and is. Ministry up in Galilee, a journey to Jerusalem, a death and by crucifixion in Jerusalem, and then resurrection. And Mark followed Peter's pattern of proclamation. And it's important to recognize that Mark never claimed to offer a blow-by-blow chronology of Jesus' earthly ministry, and so it's no surprise that he didn't provide that in his gospel. So that's a basic intro to Mark's, the structure of Mark. I know it was a little bit of a whirlwind tour. Are there any questions about the structure of Mark before we move forward to see how Matthew uses Mark's basic narrative structure? Any questions? We go pretty quickly. All right. Though Matthew, as we'll get to in a minute, adds a lot of extra material to Mark, his narrative follows Mark's basic outline, structuring his account of Jesus' ministry around a single visit to Jerusalem. So that's the most striking thing that's the same about Mark and Matthew. In the beginning of his gospel, Matthew has, of course, added in two chapters that give an account of the birth of Christ. So Luke and Matthew give accounts of Jesus' birth. Mark doesn't do that. So that's something that both Luke and Matthew, even though they follow Mark closely in many ways, have both added on a birth narrative of what took place before Mark's story starts. Mark starts with Jesus as an adult. And then in Matthew chapter 3 through 4 and verse 16 is an expanded version of the material Mark has in his 15-verse prologue. So it follows the basic pattern of Mark's prologue, but where, say, Mark says that Jesus was tempted, then we have the account. So the Mark says that Jesus was driven into the wilderness. In Matthew's gospel, we have the addition of the three temptations of Christ in the wilderness that Pastor John did the tempted and tried a series through. In 4:17 in Matthew's gospel, and it would be helpful if you had your Bibles open and we can follow along through the story. The place at which Matthew picks up Mark's primary narrative, Matthew gives us his first main narrative header. From that time, Jesus began to preach and to say, "Repent, for the kingdom of God is at hand." Like Mark, he opens his account of Jesus' public ministry with the call of the disciples by the Sea of Galilee, and he uses many of the same words in the same order as Mark does. Like I said before, there's almost certainly a literary relationship between Matthew and Mark. And like Mark, the first half of his gospel focuses on Jesus' ministry in Galilee and the Gentile regions around it, with no mention of any trips to Jerusalem. And like Mark, a central turning point of his gospel takes place with Peter's confession of faith at Caesarea Philippi in the far north, beyond the boundaries of the land of Israel. And here is where we find Matthew's second main narrative header, which corresponds precisely to the central turning point of Mark's gospel, Matthew 16:21. "From that time forth began Jesus to show unto his disciples how that he must go unto Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed and be raised again the third day." In Greek, the phrase translated as "from that time forth began Jesus" is completely identical to the phrase translated as "from that time Jesus began" in Matthew 4:17. In both cases, the Greek is apototē exito aiesus, and these are the only two times. Here's the main point. There's only two times this phrase occurs in the New Testament, are in Matthew 4:17 and Matthew 16:21, which just happened to be the beginning of Mark's narrative proper and the turning point of Mark's narrative proper. And so by using this repeated phrase, Matthew has highlighted the central turning points of Mark's narrative outline. And along the way, Matthew has incorporated, by most estimates, more than 90% of the material that is found in Mark. More than 90% of the individual stories that we see in Mark, the healings or the parables or whatever sort of material you have in Mark, you have also in Matthew. And so Mark's narrative structure relates to ministry in Galilee, followed by a climactic confession of faith by Peter at Caesarea Philippi in the far north, at the midpoint of the gospel, followed by a single journey south to Jerusalem to suffer, to die, and to rise again. And Matthew has incorporated both this basic structure as well as most of the individual stories that Mark tells us into his own gospel. So do we have any questions about that? So Mark's narrative, Matthew's narrative following the outline of Mark. Any questions or comments about that? Brother Nate.
Where was Matthew 4:17
from Mark? So it's not a, it's where it picks up, it's not a quote from Mark. So that's sort of Matthew's narrative header. And then you find the first story in Mark after the baptism is the call of the disciples, and then it's followed by the call of the disciples in Matthew. So that from that time Jesus began, that's sort of Matthew's set phrase that he uses to sort of be like a header. And we'll find that Matthew does this again with the discourses as well, where he'll repeat exactly a phrase to sort of let you know where the main turning points are. So the significance is we find this identical phrase at 4:17 and 16:21, which is where Mark's narrative begins and where Mark's narrative has this decisive turning point. And so he's sort of, even though he's added a lot of things in, those are sort of like the key hooks. And Matthew uses this phrase to highlight these are the main hooks on which the narrative is turning. Anyone else? All right. So now that we've covered the basic narrative outline of Matthew, it's time to move on to Matthew's discourses in which he summarizes the teaching of Jesus. Matthew, as we've talked about up to this point, follows the basic outline of Mark. And yet in the Greek text, Mark has only 11,314 words, while Matthew has 18,371 words. In other words, Matthew has added more than 7,000 words to Mark. While at the same time, in terms of individual stories that both Mark tells and Matthew tells, Matthew is often more concise than Mark. So it's not just like Matthew's more wordy, he's often more concise, but we still have more than 7,000 extra words in Matthew's gospel. Now, we've already mentioned the story of Jesus' birth. That's a plus of 2 chapters, but that's less than 1,000 words. So that means Matthew has, in addition to the birth narratives, added more than 6,000 extra words. What has Matthew done with all those extra words? Well, the most significant thing that Matthew has done is by adding 5 discourses, 5 blocks of teaching that together summarize the teaching ministry of Jesus. So Mark has individual parallels and some things that Jesus says, but you don't have any blocks of teaching in Mark. Mark is action, 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 action. There are parables, there are controversies, but Mark is nonstop action. And in Matthew's gospel, you find 5 blocks of teaching. The most famous of these blocks of teaching is the so-called Sermon on the Mount found in Matthew 5-7. And these blocks of teaching, while they convey the central teachings of Jesus with perfect accuracy, were never intended as, and do not claim to be, simple transcripts of Jesus' sermons. So the Gospels routinely make clear that Jesus preached all day long. At times, Jesus would preach 3 days in a row, and the people didn't even stop to eat. Now, if you read the Sermon on the Mount out loud, it takes less than 20 minutes to read the Sermon on the Mount. And only about 3 hours to read the complete Gospel of Matthew. A transcript of even one of Jesus' days of teaching, even without any accompanying narrative, would be about as long or almost as long as the New Testament as a whole. And so what Matthew has done by the inspiration of the Spirit and for the benefit of the church from his day to ours is to take the teaching of Jesus, the teaching ministry of Jesus in his earthly ministry, and to summarize it and to arrange it into topical discourses that he then inserts into the basic narrative outline provided by Peter's preaching as recorded in Mark. So the most striking thing about the way Matthew's gospel is structured is that you'll have a block of narrative and then a block of discourse, and then a block of narrative and then a block of discourse, and then a block of narrative, and then a block of discourse, and such forth and so on. So Matthew alternates between a narrative that for the most part follows Mark's narrative, and then these big blocks of extended teaching. That's the in Luke's gospel, you have a lot of teaching, but in Luke's gospel, you don't find these big blocks as such. You find smaller chunks that are more sort of interspersed with the narrative. So Luke does it a little bit differently. And while there are additional units of teaching in Matthew's gospel, Matthew has explicitly marked out by a means we'll discuss in a moment, 5 particular discourses. Does anyone wonder maybe what the number 5, what the significance of that might be? So I mentioned we're doing a 5-part series, a preface to Matthew, and I said that's kind of relevant for Matthew. Does that remind you of anything?
Attitude.
Yes, it does. And a lot of people have noticed that there are these 5 distinct discourses. And one of the things that Matthew does throughout his gospel is liken Jesus to the new and greater Moses. So the fact that you have 5 blocks of teaching is probably not accidental. So the 1st discourse is the Sermon on the Mount, what it means to be disciples. And then in chapter 10 through 11, 1, you have preparation for mission, what Jesus' disciples can expect as they serve him on mission. That's the 2nd discourse. Then the 3rd is in Matthew 13. You have the parables of the kingdom. And the 4th is in Matthew 18. You have life in the community, how Jesus' disciples are to relate to one another. And the 5th is 24 through 25, the future judgment that will separate Jesus' disciples from the false teachers. And Some would also include chapter 23, the condemnation of the scribes and the Pharisees. In this discourse, there's some discussion over that, but that's where the fifth discourse is. And so just as Matthew used a set phrase to mark the major transitions in the narrative, so also does he use a set phrase to indicate the conclusion of each of these blocks of teaching. That's how we know these are the five blocks of teaching, and some, you know, there's not seven or eight or four, because he has a particular phrase he uses to sort of highlight, I've just given you one of my five blocks of teaching. And while the King James slightly varies the translation, in Greek, the wording of this phrase, kaeneto ati atelesin o eisous, is absolutely identical in each instance. And once again, you've got this phrase, it only appears five times in the entire New Testament. And Matthew clearly intends us to use this phrase to mark off these discourses from the surrounding text. And so you have Matthew 7:28, and it came to pass when Jesus had ended these sayings, Matthew 11:1 at the end of discourse 2, and it came to pass when Jesus had made an end of commanding his 12 disciples, Matthew 13:53, and it came to pass that when Jesus had finished these parables, Matthew 19:1, and it came to pass that when Jesus had finished these sayings, Matthew 26:1, and it came to pass when Jesus had finished all these sayings, it's the fifth and final one. This is clearly a set phrase that Matthew is using to underscore how he's structuring it. And so any questions about Matthew's discourse before we move on to Matthew's symphony? So we talked about Matthew's narrative following the structure, the outline of Mark, and then we talked about how Matthew has inserted these blocks of teaching that summarize the teaching ministry of Jesus and these five particular discourses that he's set out. Any questions about that or comments? Going once, going twice. All right. So we began by talking about how Matthew follows the basic narrative structure of Mark. We then moved on to talk about the discourses that Matthew uses to summarize the teaching of Jesus. And we're now going to conclude by talking about Matthew's symphony, what I like to call the story of Israel in the key of Jesus. So in a few weeks, Lord willing, we'll dive into greater detail into the many ways that Matthew uses the Old Testament in his gospel. Tonight, we're going to focus on the way that the flow of Matthew's gospel, including both the narrative and the discourses, retells the story of Israel that's found in the Old Testament, showing how Jesus fulfills and completes and recapitulates the story of Old Testament Israel. And for the sake of both time and simplicity, we're only going to be scratching the surface. For each allusion that I mention, there are often a dozen or more details that we don't have the time to get into. But we'll explore over the course of our verse-by-verse exposition of the book. Matthew is really the key to how to read the Old Testament. Even taking the simplest approach, though, and doing the 30,000-foot flyover of what Matthew is doing, some of these details may still make your head spin just a little bit. That's perfectly all right, and in fact, it's kind of part of the point, because my primary goal is not for you to remember every one of the details that we're going to go over so quickly, but to get a sense of how Matthew works, to get a sense of how detailed and multi-layered a document Matthew really is, that there's more going on than may meet the eye at the surface. And Matthew intended us not just to sort of read over his gospel, but to dig into it. And that's what we're going to do. And that's why we're talking about this, because I want to get you ready for what we're going to be doing on Sunday morning as we work through in detail. So Matthew begins with a quotation from Genesis. The book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Now in Greek, the book of the generation is literally Biblos Geneseos. What do you think Geneseos might be? Anyone? Genesis. It's exactly the word from which we get our name Genesis. So Matthew begins by saying the book of the Genesis of Jesus Christ. And Biblos Geneseos, the book of the Genesis, is the very same words that we find. So one of the things we're going to talk about when we get to Matthew's use of the Old Testament is the significance of paying attention to the old Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures into Greek. So many of the New Testament writers are working either primarily, some, like the writer to the Hebrews, works only with the Greek Old Testament. He's not working with the Hebrew Bible. Matthew seems to be in differing places working with both Hebrew and Greek. But if we sort of want to see parallels between the Greek and the New Testament, it's very often helpful to pay attention to the Old Testament in Greek because it was already present and being used by the early church. And so when a early Greek-speaking reader or hearer of Matthew hears this book of the Genesis, that is a quotation from Genesis 5:1, which tells of the generations of Adam. And yet the allusions to the Genesis account don't stop with the first verse. Oh no. And we're just, there's so many things. We're just going to fly over here. If you go to 1:21... our next stop as we move through the story of the Old Testament as told by Matthew is Matthew 1:21. And she shall bring forth a son, and thou shalt call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins. Does that ring any bells? Is there any story you may think of when you hear that in the Old Testament? Promise a son would be born to someone who shouldn't have been able to conceive a son. Abraham. And if Genesis 17:19, and God said, Sarah, thy wife shall bear thee a son indeed, and thou shalt call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant and with his seed after him. Now, here's the crazy thing. It's not just at the story level, but if you compare the Greek text of Genesis 17:19 and the Greek text of Matthew 1:21, you'll find that they're almost identical. It's basically almost a direct quotation from Genesis, and there's only one other place in the Old Testament that has that basic form of words. What place do you think that might be that also is quoting from Genesis in the Old Testament? Isaiah 7:14, which Matthew also quotes. He's tying the Old Testament together. And if you learn to hear what he's doing, you realize there's so much more going on than you see at first glance. Matthew is intentionally alluding to the birth of Isaac. Now, who was Isaac? Whose father was he? He was the son of Abraham. Isaac is the son of Abraham. Matthew has just told us the book of the Genesis of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. So it's no surprise that when he tells about the birth of Jesus, he alludes to the birth of Isaac. And there's so much more, but we have to move on. So our next stop is in chapter 2 in verse 16, where we find the wicked king Herod killing all the male babies in Bethlehem. And the Greek text makes it clear he's not killing all the babies, he's killing the male babies. Who is it that liked to kill male babies in the Old Testament? Pharaoh. So we're moving through the story of the Old Testament, and we come to the wicked Pharaoh who kills male babies. Chapters 2 and 4, next we find Jesus coming up out of Egypt and passing through the water. And while the Jordan River, the fact that he passes through the Jordan River might make you think of the crossing of the Jordan, we haven't gotten that far in the story yet. Because as soon as Jesus passes through the water, he heads into the wilderness where he faces tests. And that's exactly what happened. When Israel crosses the Red Sea, they go into the wilderness and they're tested and they fail the test. But Jesus goes into the wilderness and he passes the test. He's retelling the story of Israel, only where in the old story there had been failure, now there is victory. Of course, already in the Old Testament, the crossing of the Jordan alludes back to the crossing of the Red Sea. And often a single event in Matthew will allude to multiple Old Testament stories or figures. And one of the reasons for this is that this sort of elusive storytelling is already central to the way the Old Testament narratives themselves work. If you read the Old Testament narratives carefully, you'll find that there's cross-references backwards and forwards in the story, that earlier stories are told in such a way that they prepare you for later stories, and later stories are told in such a way that they remind you of earlier stories. In a few months here, we're going to be starting into the text of Exodus on Sunday night once we finish the Matthew series. And one of the things that takes place in Exodus is just about everything that happens to Israel is prefigured in the life of Moses. Moses prefigures the story of Israel just as Jesus refigures the story of Israel. Telling one story in a way that makes you think of another story or prepares you for that story is at the heart of how Hebrew narrative works. That's what the Old Testament is doing, page after page after page after page. And that's what the Gospels are doing. And until we learn to hear that, to see that, to recognize that, we're going to miss so much of what they are saying. Because as we'll find out as we work through Matthew, not only is it going through the story of Israel, but time and time again, Jesus is stepping into this story and he is claiming to be and to do what only the Lord God of Israel was and did in the Old Testament. And that's how Jesus establishes his divine identity, is by going back to the story. And as you see the story and you see the part that Jesus is playing in that story, you see that's the part played by the Lord God himself. And that's what drives the Pharisees to want to kill him, because he's claiming in the clearest way possible to be God himself. The next thing that happens, once again in keeping with the narrative of the Pentateuch, is that Jesus heads up a mountain to deliver a discourse that alludes over and over and over again to the law that Moses gave on Mount Sinai. Now, we don't have time, so it's no surprise that the first of Matthew's discourses is the one that connects to the giving of the covenant code found in the book of Exodus. And though we don't have time to get into them tonight, there are many, many allusions at every level of the discourse that tie back to what we find in the giving of the law in Exodus. Now, chapters 8 through 9, this is the coolest part to me. Because after the book of Exodus, we find the book of Leviticus. And what do you find in Leviticus? You find laws about what? Some of the gross stuff. Tell me the gross stuff in Leviticus. The offerings, but cleanness and uncleanness. What are some of the clean and unclean things? You find rules about leprosy. What else do you find rules about? What? You find rules about diet. Yep, pigs. You find mention of don't eat pigs. So you find leprosy, pigs. What about issues of blood? All that sort of gross stuff about what to do with bodily issues. That's in Leviticus. After the book of Exodus, we find the book of Leviticus, which is concerned with the clean and the unclean, with leprosy and with pigs, and with forgiveness of sins, the Day of Atonement, and with issues of blood. And no surprise then that immediately after the Sermon on the Mount, you have chapters 8 and 9 of Matthew, and it's this carefully arranged set of miracles that deals with leprosy and pigs and forgiveness of sin and issues of blood. And we know that Matthew has done this on purpose because these stories appear in different orders in the other Gospels. But Matthew has this special structure where he has 1, 2, 3 miracles, and then a saying of Jesus. 1, 2, 3 miracles, then a saying of Jesus. 1, 2, 3 miracles, and then a saying of Jesus. And you actually have a 10th miracle, so you have 10 total miracles in 8 through 9. And then in Numbers, it explicitly says that Israel tempted God 10 times in the wilderness. And so now Jesus is dealing with the failures of Israel, and he is responding to where they had fallen prey to idolatry. Jesus is delivering them the exact number of times that they had failed, and also connecting to all of the regulations in Leviticus and fulfilling those. If you get the sense, this goes really deep. It does. And we better move on, though, because we're only in chapter 9. In 9:35 through 36, we find a summary of all that Jesus has done up to this point. And Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and preaching the gospel of the kingdom and healing every sickness and every disease among the people. But when he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion on them because they fainted and were scattered abroad as sheep having no shepherd. Where does that language of sheep having no shepherd come from? Does anyone remember? Where do we find that? Anyone? Nate? So we do talk about the bad shepherds in Ezekiel, but it appears earlier in the story. And having just been told, it appears actually in the book of Numbers, having just been told that he and Aaron will not enter the promised land, Moses pleads with the Lord to appoint a leader so that the congregation of the Lord be not as sheep which have no shepherd. Sheep which have no shepherd is a cue to the story of Joshua, who comes after Moses. So we've worked our way through the Pentateuch. We've worked our way through the story of Israel on the verge of the promised land. And now we come to something that clearly alludes to Joshua. And that gets us to the beginning of the conquest of Canaan. Now, before we move on to the rest of Matthew, are there any questions about what we've covered up to this point? Questions? All right, let's plow right ahead. While the flow of the story is clearest in the way that the first nine chapters relate to the Pentateuch, Matthew's pattern of allusions does not stop with chapter 9, but continues all the way to the end of the gospel. So I've talked about a symphony. Once we get to the end of chapter 9, Matthew dials down the volume just a little bit, but the symphony keeps going on. In chapter 10, the second of Matthew's topically arranged discourses, we find Jesus giving instructions to his 12 disciples as they prepare to go forth into all the cities of Israel, facing down the demonic forces that are holding them in bondage. So we had an allusion to Joshua, the sheep which have no shepherd. Now we have Jesus sending his disciples into all the land of Israel to go cast out demons. What's that remind you of? The conquest. Exactly. And no surprise, chapter 10, it's filled with encouragement not to fear, but instead to be bold and courageous, which of course is the theme of the book of Joshua. In chapter 11, we find Jesus offering all those who are weary and heavy laden with the bondage produced by idolatry, the bondage borne by the people of God in the book of Judges, an easy yoke and a light burden. So Judges is all about how they're burdened down by oppression. And Jesus offers them rest. Matthew 12 through 13, we move to the United Kingdom. Chapter 12 of Matthew opens with the recounting of a story of what David did when he's running from Saul. Jesus identifies himself with David. And later on in the chapter, the people, astonished by Jesus, ask whether he is the son of David. At the end of chapter 12, we find Jesus claiming to be greater than... who's David's son? Solomon. So we have allusions to David, then we have Jesus claiming to be greater than Solomon, then we have chapter 13, which is the parables of the kingdom. Now, who in the Old Testament is associated with the giving of parables? Solomon. And here's once again where paying attention to the Greek text of the Old Testament is important, because in 1 Kings 4:32, we find this, and he spake 3,000 proverbs. What do you think the Greek word that's found there is? Anyone? It's parable, the word from which we get parable. So if you're reading Matthew, Matthew's hearers are hearing parables, and they're thinking, who is it that speaks lots and lots of parables in the Old Testament? Why, it's Solomon. Jesus just said he's greater than Solomon. And so it's no surprise that we find a whole bunch of parables that come right after that. And so just as the first discourse was associated with Moses going up on a mountain and handing down the law to his disciples, the second discourse is associated with Joshua going into the land and conquering the demonic forces that oppose the people of God. So the third discourse, the parables of the kingdom, giving the wise king who is instructing, who is a teacher, Jesus is doing what Solomon did, only doing it better because he doesn't foolishly fail. And then Matthew 14 through 17 take us to the dark days of the divided kingdom. And it opens with the story of the death of John the Baptist at the instigation of Herodias. Just as Jezebel sought to slay the prophets of God, so also does Herodias. And like Ahab, Herod himself is an ambivalent figure, sorry to see John die, but unwilling to stand up to his wife that he shouldn't have married to begin with. Point by point, it's Ahab and Jezebel over again. And throughout these chapters, there are constant parallels to the miracles wrought by Elijah and Elisha. And so just as John the Baptist is Elijah that Herodias is trying to kill, so Jesus is doing the miracles of Elisha over again. So the most striking miracles associated with Elisha is that he multiplies bread. He feeds the people of God. Then we find a second story where it's not a miracle, but we find that Elisha makes sure that the Syrian army, a group of pagan men, gets fed bread and water. So Elisha multiplies bread once miraculously, but he also feeds the pagans. So it's no surprise that we find two feeding miracles in which Jesus is multiplying bread, and also one in which he is feeding pagans. And we also find lots and lots of mentions to Elijah. Elijah is mentioned by name 9 times in the Gospel of Matthew. 6 of those 9 times is in Matthew 14 through 17. There's a bunch of references to Elijah here. And of course, you have the Transfiguration where he actually shows up as well. And then we move on to Matthew 18 through 25, and we have prophetic hope and judgment. Because as you read through the Hebrew Bible, after the work of the miracle-working prophets, Elijah and Elisha, one comes to the great writing prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the book of the 12. So you have the former prophets, which tells the story from Joshua to the end of 2 Kings. And then you have the latter prophets, which is Isaiah through the book of the 12, which is the name for the minor prophets. It sort of forms one book to itself. And in these prophets, we find words of both hope for the final restoration of the people of God and words of judgment on the false leaders who are leading them astray. Brother Nate already mentioned that, judgment on the false shepherds in the book of Ezekiel. And this is exactly the combination that we find in Matthew 18 through 25. So in Matthew 18, the fourth of Matthew's discourses, we find instructions on how to maintain and to restore unity in the community. So we find hope for a new community that will exist after the judgment is over. And in Matthew 23, we find a strident condemnation of the false leaders of Israel, echoing the combination of the false religious leaders that we find in Jeremiah and Ezekiel. These are the things that fill the latter prophets. And in Matthew 24 through 25, the fifth and final of the 5 discourses in which Matthew has thematically arranged Jesus' teaching, we find Jesus in language saturated with references to the Old Testament prophets dealing with the events that will lead to the final judgment that those prophets predicted. So we've gone from the Pentateuch to the former prophets, from Joshua to Kings, to the latter prophets. Now, what takes place after that? What takes place after the latter prophets? What's the next thing after the prophets prophesy judgment? What happens? What? Captivity? What's another word for captivity? It's the... starts with an E. Exile. And in Matthew 26 through 28, we're told about the death, the burial, and the resurrection of Jesus. As should come as no surprise by this point, there are repeated references to the exile. Just as the people of God were driven outside of their city to suffer, so also was Jesus. And as Jesus hangs on the cross, exiled from the city of Jerusalem, the passersby revile him, wagging their head. And while it certainly alludes, so the wagging of the head certainly alludes to Psalm 22, but it also brings to mind Lamentations 2:15, where the hostile nations exulting over the destruction of the city wag their heads at the daughter of Jerusalem. Jesus is going through the exile. And just as the righteous sufferer in Lamentations 3:15 is given gall to drink, so all through... also, Matthew mentions uniquely among the 4 Gospels, Jesus is given gall to drink. Going back, it's a direct allusion to the book of Lamentations. Not only do Jesus' enemies explicitly mention the destruction of the temple, but when Jesus dies, the veil of the temple is symbolically torn from top to bottom. So the great tragedy of the exile from the point of God's faithful people is the destruction of the temple. And Jesus, the true temple of God, seems to have been destroyed. He has gone through an exile of his own. And yet exile was not the end of Jesus' story. Because the great resurrection prophecy of the valley of dry bones in Ezekiel 37 is in fact a prophecy of Israel's return from the judgment of exile. What fixes the problem of exile is resurrection. And see, that was the crisis that God's people were facing in the time of Christ. The exile in Persia was over, but the resurrection that had been promised hadn't come yet. The hopes that the prophets had prophesied of deliverance from sin, that hadn't happened. And yet in Jesus, it did happen, because Jesus did rise from the grave on the third day. And the resurrection of Jesus is therefore the signal that the exile of God's people is at long last really and truly over. And the pouring out of the Spirit on the day of Pentecost, which of course takes place after the book of Matthew, is the signal that is a permanent reminder that the promises that were waiting the end of the exile have now begun to be fulfilled. And it should therefore come as no surprise that just as 2 Chronicles, how does 2 Chronicles end? How does the story end? It ends with a commission to go and do what? Does anyone remember? Cyrus is giving a commission to go and do something. Build the temple. So at the end of Matthew's gospel, Jesus gives a commission to his disciples to go out and to gather disciples that will form the living stones that will be the true and final temple of God. Well, I would not want to insist with equal fervor on each and every one of these allusions, and I'm certainly open to revising my opinion. We've covered a lot of ground in the past few minutes on some of the details as we work through the text in more detail. The cumulative weight of even the small handful of references we have taken the time to work through over the past few minutes is already quite striking. This isn't just two or three data points. This is dozens and dozens of data points, and that's only skimming the surface of what we could cover in a few minutes. By the use of a wide variety of means, Matthew has underscored the point that we will see in a few weeks. He already makes in his genealogy. Jesus is the true Israel, the one in whom all the promises of God, as Paul put it, find their yes and amen. The one who is the second century church father Irenaeus long ago realized recapitulates the story of Israel, enabling the glorious covenant promises of God to be finally poured out. Any questions? And I have a question for you. We covered a lot of different allusions to the Old Testament narrative in the past few minutes. Was there any particular allusion that really stuck out to you? So any questions that you have, or any of the allusions that really stuck out to you as something that you thought was neat or hadn't seen before or noticed before? Or had noticed before and just are still really excited about? So any questions or anything that really stuck out to you? Brother Nate. Uh-huh. But it's a quote where Moses is pleading for the appointment of Joshua. Mm-hmm. It's the same name exactly. Yes, I think so, but I'm going to want to probably, I will dig into that more when I get to that text.
And then another question on that is, when people met him and he's out there, and people, the hubbub is that this guy was a society, so he was coming to prophesy, and then they find out his name is Jesus. Did they make that connection?
Like, maybe. I don't get the sense that there was the cultural expectation that was going to be a new Joshua. So I think of sort of like the Moses typology in Matthew is very strong. The David is strong as well. I'd say of sort of like the notes that Matthew is sounding, that's a lighter one, but I still think it's present. So it's the maybe one of the strongest expectations is in Deuteronomy 18, the prophet like unto Moses. That's one of the things. So understanding exactly we can talk about this more later too, but understanding exactly the messianic expectations of the first century turns out to be a lot harder than you would think, just because of we don't have as much data as we would like. Right. It's possible, yeah. I would want to probably dig into that some more, but it's certainly possible. Do you have your hand up, Hannah? Anyone else? Silas. Just the way it's also the story, that the story, and it's like Jesus is the missing. It's, and that's what you get. You see this in Luke, where he opens their eyes to understand the scriptures. And it's like he gives them a new set of glasses. And they look back at the story that has been confusing before. And all of a sudden, all the pieces fall into place. And it's this hermeneutical transformation of their way they're reading the Old Testament. Now they're reading it differently. And that's really just really quite astonishing. Anyone else? Brother Dean. Yeah.
He's the end of perfection. Christ is the end of perfection.
Yeah, and there's a lot of connections to be made there for sure. Well, our time is about out, so any further comments and questions you can come tell me afterwards. We began our time this evening by discussing how Matthew follows the basic narrative outline of Mark. We moved on to summarizing the five discourses in which Matthew summarizes the teaching of Jesus. And we concluded by discussing Matthew's symphony, the way in which he, with varying degrees of volume, replays the story of Israel in the key of Jesus. As an example of the discipled scribe Jesus spoke of in 1352, Matthew has brought forth out of his treasure things both new and old. My prayer as we work through his gospel is that each of us would be better equipped to do the same. And you are now dismissed.